Good evening. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey, along with K2 KEY Mel. We intend to start TechNet number 1214 of the series that began in September of 1982. The TechNet is a gathering of the clan, the ham radio clan, in which quite a few of these guys have got quite a bit of knowledge. They represent lots of years of experience, and they teach us all how to get more enjoyment out of the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM repeater, 2-meter ham radio, which you're listening to right now, just one of the 25. And if for some reason you're displeased with this one, you ought to sometimes give consideration to one of the other 24. The subjects that are appropriate for the TechNet are almost any subject of interest to ham radio operators. They're curious people. They got sort of a science bent, many of them, not all of them. And they want to know how to make their transmitters work better, their antennas work better. How do their antennas work? How does those feed line work? Why does it behave that way? What's propagation like? What is this thing called meteor scatter, moon bounce, tropo scatter, sporadic E, transequatorial, E-layer, F-layer propagation? Why is the D-layer doing that at high noon? These kind of questions. Sometimes you get into the philosophy of ham radio. Sometimes you get into FCC rules. Sometimes you get into the science of how transistors and amplifiers work. A person signs into the TechNet, giving us his call letters, his name, and affirming, which means they do have a question or a comment for the net. A possible sign-in would sound like this. K2KEY, Mel, and yes. Do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Steve recognized. Anyone else?
WS2N, Paul. Space report. Good evening, Dick.
Good for your space report. I bet you'll have a question, too. All right, we've got Steve and Paul. Anyone else?
N2GOT, Howard, no.
Howard recognized with a no. And you're allowed to change that to a yes later on if you want to. I bet almost everybody's watching the interview with Barack Obama. Anyone else?
Good evening, all. K2KEY.
And what's your handle, sir? That was a joke. Okay. No recognized. Anyone else?
KB1NNH, Jerry. No.
Is that KB1 November Mike Hotel?
KB1 November November Hotel.
Very fine, Jerry. And so far with a no. Anyone else? One last call. Anyone with a check-in with a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now.
KC12 RU for check.
Mr. LYU. What is your name, sir?
It's Danielle. I want some information. And Mel is there. Yeah, I want to know something for automatic tuner on the radio, an antenna, and something in a lot of air come out, about 9 dB.
Okay. Mel, you want to give Daniel a quick comment on what he just said?
Yeah, Danny, this is K2KEY. Are you talking about the radio you were on today on 10 meters? Over.
Just about today. Back to you. And also, I have another problem. The every time in the night time, at this time, enter my just about 20 dB. Give me this answer. I'm on site. Listen.
All right, the Intermodi's picking up there. I can't give you an answer to that. There, as far as the 440 is concerned, the problem with that is, like I say, you first got to put it into a dummy load and see if the tuner, the auto tuner, then works correctly. It shouldn't be hunting around. If it works correctly, then it's your antenna is at fault, Danny. So no other way I could tell you to do it simply. All right, back to you, Dick.
Okay. KC2, oh, that's, I got the wrong standby minute. Yep. These guys on 101st Street have this moment to Danny. And we're going to come back to you, Danny, for a further discussion. Intermodulation distortion and signals that shouldn't be coming through your receiver. Complicated subject. One or two weeks ago, we did, Mel and I did a bit on that one. We know we didn't cover the whole subject. There are people who have spent their career studying the instantaneous dynamic range of a receiver and why the good news is it's so sensitive they can, you know, listen to a signal of a very small fraction of 1 microvolt. That's the good news. But you put them in a metropolitan environment like Brooklyn, like 101st Street in Brooklyn, there are strong signals nearby, and occasionally you're going to be getting signals you don't want. Even the guys on Dover Street occasionally get that problem. So Steve is the first guy we signed in with a question. Steve, looks like until the Barack Obama interview is over, our check-ins are a little bit late, so you can take your own sweet time. What would you like to talk about, Steve? KT2MDB, KT2LIW.
Good evening to you, Dick. Good evening, Mel, and everyone else out on the net. This is KC2MVP. Name here is Steve. Dick, I have two questions, if that's cool with you, both concerning transformers. I'll give you question one, and then I'll proceed to question two, if that's cool. If you don't want to answer question two, no big deal. Okay, question one is, I ran into a problem with a switching transformer. Basically, it got overvoltaged. You know, I was running it on a generator, and, you know, when I disconnected the load, the only thing left on that was this transformer, and I guess the generator ran away, overvoltaged it. Well, anyway, what happens, it blew the fuse in there. It also blew this little, it looked like a ceramic disc capacitor. You know, I looked in there, I found out what the symbol was, I looked the symbol up, and it was switching, they call it switching, not a switching, a trigger diode. And, basically, you know, I looked it up, and from what I got is that this trigger diode, basically, it closes on a certain voltage, if I'm correct with that, and I would imagine that this thing, you know, once it reached, let's say, you know, 140 volts, this trigger diode would close, cause the fuse to blow, and, you know, that's that story. What I ended up doing is replacing that trigger diode with one of those MOVs, you know, that's rated to, activated 120 volts. Now, is that the same thing as a trigger diode, or is that basically like, does it absorb the incoming voltage surge? And question two is another transformer. I came across a problem with one of these, you know, wall warts, and this thing is for a Linksys router. Basically, the transformer went dead. I replaced the transformer with a beefier one, and just out of curiosity, I took this sucker apart and found out, you know, that there's a big burn mark in this thing. Now, the only thing that concerned me was behind the circuit board is like a piece of foam rubber, you know, like you'd find like a couch or something, and this thing was pretty well charred. You know, I called up Linksys, and, you know, I sort of addressed my concerns to them. And, you know, they said they'd email me back with some sort of, you know, reply, and it's been 2 weeks, and I guess basically it fell on deaf ears. Now, this thing, should I pursue this further? And if I should pursue this further, who should I talk to about this transformer that could possibly start a fire? Back to you, Dick.
Okay. I'm going to express some opinions and then pass it over to the group on each of your questions. On the first question, a trigger diode. I can think of two different ways you can get a trigger diode. One would be electronically creating something internally similar to a unijunction transistor. And if you did a Google search on unijunction transistors, they made a very nice kind of a relaxation oscillator, popular item in the late 60s. I built some very nice circuits with those. I own some of them. Don't know if they still exist, the particular part numbers I have. But the way they work is it was a kind of a negative feedback device. If you looked at some of the early General Electric transistor manuals explaining how transistors work, you would see that if you took a certain combination of two transistors, I think it was an NPN and a PNP, and you wired them together in a particular manner, you could get a situation where as you apply voltage across the thing, it stays an open circuit until it hits a critical voltage. And 140 volts or 160 volts is a possible voltage.
You got to be careful now. The so-called 120 volt line. When you take your true RMS voltmeter and put it across those two terminals in your wall, and Con Ed or LIPA supplies you something like 120 volts. That's the voltage. That's the average heating value. If you put that 120 volts into a 120 ohm resistor, it would draw an average AC current of 1 ampere, and you'd get 120 watts of heating, if I did the math right. That's what RMS means, heating value. But if you put it on your carefully calibrated oscilloscope, that 120 volt RMS voltage hits 167 volts positive peak on the first half of the cycle, and 167 volts negative peak on the second half of the cycle. And it's also spending some time going through zero. So it averages the same amount of heating into a pure resistor as 120 volts direct current. If you had 120 volts coming out of a battery, you'd get a certain amount of heating. And you take that line voltage of yours, you get the exact same amount of heating into a pure resistor. But it hits a peak of 167. So if you went and got some kind of a device that triggers at 120...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And that device triggers at 120 volts absolute, you would be false alarming much too soon. In order to get overvoltage protection for a 120 volt line, I would choose something in the vicinity of 185 volts of trigger voltage. Now, we got a little bit of a problem of terms here. If I had a device in my hand that was intended for 120 volt line protection, and it triggers at, I'm going to pick a number, 185 volts absolute peak, the marking on it might say 120 volt triggering device for that value of AC, so to speak. So you got to be a little bit careful. Now, MOVs and trigger diodes, I think, are different. MOVs usually are put directly across the line in order to absorb the power directly, even before the fuse, so to speak. That's the typical way they're used. And as long as you don't abuse them, they can take quite a few hits, so to speak, absorb a great big spike that comes roaring down your line from a lightning strike that took place a block away. If it happens at your house, nothing is going to save you. All these devices will give you a little bit of protection, but they're not going to give you perfect protection. So the exact trigger voltage, you got to worry about that. Now, it is obvious from what you're describing that your trigger diode did get triggered. Your MOV, you got to worry about the instantaneous voltage. In other words, look at the specifications for it carefully to find out before you put back that fuse and some kind of a protection device, MOV, trigger diode, or whatever. And it's probably a way of getting the exact trigger diode back in there. You can get your switching transformer. And I think by switching transformer, you probably mean inverter. Something that you put... You did say switching transformer. Maybe you meant switching power supply. Something you put 120 volts in on one side, and 12 volts comes out the other side. You'll have to clear that one up for me. Now, on your second subject, let me drop. When it comes to a wall wart, I was working on a wall wart today, and it's the one that powers my... non-Bell Laboratory telephone. It's a brand X telephone, which has all kinds of recording devices and whatever. And I thought that the transformer, the wall wart, and it had failed. And I started measuring the DC voltage coming out of it, and it was zero. And I said, aha, it's bad. And I was about to start working on the actual telephone itself, and I suddenly found out the telephone has an on-off button. When I pressed it, everything came back to life. I said, hey, how can that be? And I suddenly found out that my particular wall wart takes the 120 volts in and puts 12 volts out of AC, 12 volts AC. So the wall wart, in my case, puts out AC voltage. That goes into the telephone, which has a full-wave bridge rectifier network, which converts it into DC and then operates the phone from it. Most of the wall mods you'll run into really have rectifier and sometimes a slight filter in it, and they really put out DC. Once you find out that your particular appliance that used that burned-up wall wart, if you know what voltage and current it ran on, you could, if you want to, go through all the rigmarole of repairing it, where it has already been damaged, and because they are usually so darn inexpensive, you might want to go and repair it just for the science and the knowledge and the experience. But if you walk into Radio Shack, and if you find that your particular appliance needs 12 volts at 300 milliamps, and you go into Radio Shack and you buy a wall wart equivalent, at least they used to have them, and you buy the one that's 12 volts at more than 300 milliamps, 500 milliamps, and just simply replace. In other words, in most cases, there's nothing magic about that exact brand name of wallwort that was on your original appliance. You can go and substitute with a known better one that maybe is going to be more reliable. Where both of your devices failed, it does imply that you did have a spike coming down your line from a lightning bolt, or occasionally your local power company puts out a spike inadvertently because somebody hit a telephone pole, and in the process of that line being shorted to ground when the telephone pole fell over, a spike occurred. Things like that do occur. And so both of your appliances may have been damaged at the same time. Now, Mel, when you run into these problems, and I bet you you've got some hints as to what you do. K2KEY for some suggestions. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, noisy, a little noisy. Is the repeater a little noisy on your end also, Dick?
Yes, it is a little bit, but I got to be careful. My particular radio is giving me a little bit of a bridge tonight, and so I'm hearing noise out of my radio that's not coming out of the repeater. While you're talking, I'm going to test into my better radio and see if the repeater's putting out the noise, or if it's your particular antenna. On the input, you sound good. Not to worry. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed that. Well, anyhow, as far as these wall warts and all, you notice they are sealed units, and you're not supposed to really open them. I have cracked open quite a number of them. I think almost every one of them I, one time or another, had a, you know, parted. There's a little trick to opening them without busting the case up. As far as replacing the components in them, no doubt if you contact the company, just as you said, that it falls on deaf ears because they actually do not consider these a repairable type of devices. These are throwaway type situations. But if you want to repair them, if you get, like, for instance, look in the ECG book, you'll see as far as those trigger diodes, MOVs and all, they're all listed there. They all have a replacement number that you can get a hold of. The point is, you'll wind up, I think, spending for the individual components that you got to replace in there more than the units you could purchase it, you know, in whole. Unless, I guess, the Dick said, you know, you just want to experiment. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, that's what I recommend. I'm just looking now. I just realized I've got another one of these wall warts that replaces the one that I thought had failed, which it hadn't at all. But it's not intended to be repairable. A company who mails you parts, which means they're getting involved with you taking apart a device not intended to be taken apart, and then you making replacements inside, and maybe not resealing it correctly, so that now it's a more dangerous item where a child can come along and put his hand on that cracked case, open the case, and expose his little fingers to the voltage. There's always there's a risk liability, a legal liability that the company who manufactured that wall wart is suddenly entering into. If they give you advice as to how to break the case, open it up, repair the parts inside, and then they supply you repairing parts. In other words, if they were being a good Samaritan and helping out this ham radio operator who is being very economic, they could, in theory, open themselves up to a lawsuit. So not only are they busy, don't want to, there's no real profit in them supplying the part you need. I mean, the whole darn thing is probably made in Southeast Asia for 75 cents, and just the amount of time they spend with you on the telephone, mailing you the parts, billing you, whatever, it ain't worth it. I can see why you're not likely to get all that you want out of the company unless you happen to run into a ham radio operator there that feels sorry for you. So repairing it without them is a possible approach, but simply replacing it. I mean, we all like to use the exact original component. Well, sometimes the exact original component is not a reliable one. And the one you can get from Radio Shack, even though it's not very expensive, and not exactly the same brand name, as long as it has the same voltage and the same current and the same kind of a connector, I'll admit that's a little bit of a pain. The actual 12-volt connector, is the center pin positive or negative? And is it a small, medium, or large diameter on the center pin? And a small, medium, or large diameter on the outer sleeve of the actual 12-volt input coaxial connector? That's a bit of a pain. And with some difficulty, you can get the right connector. And some of the things you saw, I used to be able to buy at Radio Shack, was a bubble pack Walmart, Walwart One of them, as I remember, you could set it for 6 volts, 9 volts, 12 volts, 15 volts output. And you had a bunch of little plug-in things on the output where you could choose the right connector that matched your particular...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You could choose the right connector that matched your particular appliance. So I would strongly consider complete replacement in the case of your question number two. But your question number one, you called it a switching transformer. You're going to have to give me a couple more words as to what that means, Steve. We probably have only begun to answer your question, but at least you see the direction which we're going. KC2, MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, very good, Dick. Yeah, my bad on question number one. It's a switching power supply. It's actually, a battery charger for a cordless drill. And that happened at work. Now, perhaps you misunderstood me on question number two as far as this wall wart. I mean, number one happened to work through a generator. Number two just happened to go bad. I did change it. I just went out. My boss just happened to have a 5-volt power supply that he used to use for his zip drive. It was pin positive. It fit in there perfectly. The amperage was a little bit higher. But my concern is with this wall wart, is like I said, I took this wall wart apart that originally came from Linksys. And I mean, this thing was pretty charred inside. And behind the circuit board, they had like this piece of foam rubber, like the same stuff you'd find like in a seat cushion of a couch. And this stuff was pretty charred black. And I had called them up expressing my concerns that this wall wart might start a fire. Is there how many of them out there? Are you guys still making this thing? I'm just trying to express to them that basically mine went dead. I opened it up just out of sheer curiosity and found that this piece of foam rubber you guys put back in there was pretty charred black. I don't want to see anyone having a fire. And like I said, they basically said, we'll talk to the engineering team and everything else. We'll give you an email back. And, I guess basically it fell on deaf ears. Should I pursue this? Should I call, Consumer Affairs or something? Do you think it's, one in a million shot that my wall wart went bad and charred the living heck out of this piece of foam rubber? Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to make a guess that the foam rubber was in there as some kind of a mechanical support. In other words, if the wall wart gets dropped on the ground, it acts as a cushion so that the internal components don't get slammed up against the case. And what I think you're concerned about is the foam rubber, when overheated, a fire retardant material or a fire supporting material? The fact that it got charred and didn't burn is a good sign, but it's not enough. So you're worried about whether or not it's properly fire protected. And I guess the real thing to worry about, does the case of the wall wart have a UL rating on it? Is there a little circle, and inside the circle it says UL, in which case the Underwriters Laboratory, in theory, has approved that particular device for its human safety on shock hazard and a child coming up against it when it's plugged into the wall with his wet little fingers and so on, and whether or not it creates fire. If it has an Underwriters Laboratory approval, and if it's a real UL approval, and not just one that was put on there that's a phony, if you know what I mean, then in theory somebody's already worried about it. Maybe I wouldn't be concerned. But if you really want to go the next step, I guess you could take a sample of that rubber, bring it to a chemical laboratory and find out, is it something that would support fire? Is there enough of it there that when it's caught on fire, with the case intact, and it's therefore airwise sealed off from the rest of the environment, could it really burn? I mean, you may have a flammable substance inside of a small case, but if the case is sealed, not cracked open by you, it can't get a continuous supply of air, and therefore it can smolder a little bit at first until it consumes the air it's got inside, the oxygen, and after that it can't burn any further. So it's possible that Underwriters Laboratory said even though it's a flammable material, there's such a small amount of air inside that it can't create enough heat to do any damage. It can't burn itself out of the case. And maybe the case is made out of a fireproof plastic. So, I'm not quite sure how far I would get involved in this. Anyone who's listening to what we've said so far, if you have any comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Go right ahead, Glenn.
No, try Mel.
Dick, now let me let it drop.
Now, there is really a Glenn there as well as the Mel. Mel first and then Glenn after you. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. What they usually do with the wall warts, you'll notice that the two wires that go to the plug that's molded into the case usually are very thin wires, and they act as fuses. Basically, if you look at the wire and you see, what the heck, why did they use like number 28 or 30 wire or something from the two terminals, you know, from the, that plug into the wall that's molded in there? And that's actually the fuse device, Dick, over.
Yeah, some people call that a fusible link when they put in a small diameter wire. Every one of your IC2AT radios, believe it or not, has on the schematic diagram what looks like a 0-ohm resistor that goes from the 12-volt input lead, and it's a little lead that's the place where you plug in, say, for instance, a charger that plugs into the cigarette lighter of the car. It looks like there's a 1-ohm resistor there. Well, quite a number of the IC2ATs I've gotten my hands on, just the that is not really a 1-ohm resistor. Even though the tape mentions it, it's a 1-ohm resistor with a very fine wire that, when you do something wrong, like if, for instance, your particular cigarette lighter, when you run the starter motor on your car, is drawing 250 amperes, and at the instant you stop cranking the starter motor and you let go of the starter function, and you get the inductive kickback from that heavy magnetic field that's in the starter motor, and it may put a spike of 24 volts on your cigarette lighter. Cigarette lighter heater element wouldn't give a darn, but your electronics connected to that would. And so that that fusible link resistor is supposed to absorb that difference so that the full 24 volts doesn't go roaring into your handy-talky. Well, in a number of cases, that 1-ohm resistor becomes partially damaged. It's still making contact, but it's making a scratchy contact. And when you replace it, the radio behaves a lot better. I've got two IC2ATs with that problem, where somebody has, before I owned them, plugged in 12 volts that had a spike on it that exceeded the value of that fusible link. So let's see what Glenn's got to say. You work with all kinds of UL-approved hardware from time to time, consumer products, don't you, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Oh, good evening, Dick. Yeah, actually, I work for a company now that produces the largest number of wall warts for just about all manufacturers in the world. Interesting thing about the UL mark, if you have a wall wart that does have a UL mark on it, the first thing to look for is next to the UL mark is a file number. And that file number, you don't even have to go back to the manufacturer. Forget the manufacturer. Call UL up. They have a telephone number. If you're really interested in safety on that product, you can, they'll match that file number and UL number and the product. So in other words, there should be a product number on it, a UL file number, and you can trace it right back to UL. And they UL actually holds all the test reports and everything that was done at all materials. They're supposed to be inside that part, and flammability is certainly one of the requirements that it has to pass. So you can actually trace that right back to UL, and UL just happens to be here on Long Island, right in Melville. So it would be a local call, practically. So back over to you, Dick, KC2QIQ.
Now, once again, did you tell me, Glenn, that I can go to the UL website with that file number, and without even troubling them on the telephone, I can look up the data of that particular unit?
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, you can, and depending on how much you get out of that, as I said, they're locally here on Long Island, and you could research it directly through the product. I mean, that is their business. They are there as a product approval service, both for the producer and for the client, the customer, the person buying the product. That's who they're protecting, KC2QIQ.
How long have you worked for that firm that builds the most number of Walmarts in the world? That's question number one. Sounds like fun work you're involved in there, Glenn. I can tell by all the things you've been telling us over the months. Second of all, in your opinion, roughly what percentage of the Walmarts put out rectified DC or filtered DC or regulated DC versus AC? I was kind of amazed that my particular wall watt for my telephone puts out 12 volts AC. Now back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I can't speak for all the wall warts in the world, but I can speak for the ones that my company manufactures. I've been there right now since January this year. Switched jobs just after the start of this past year. Most of the time, I'm not really working on the Woolworths, Dick. I actually have got, like, other responsibilities, but that is one of the products that we do produce. But as far, I would say, as far as Woolworths from product lines that I've seen being produced today, I would say probably better than 95% have a form of DC output, and the numbers of AC are probably well under and under 5% at KC2QIQ.
That was my guess, Glenn, that AC output was kind of rare. And it was quite a surprise to me when I thought I had a dead Woolwart because I couldn't see any DC output. And then all of a sudden when I pressed the right buttons on my phone, I was about ready to take the phone apart because I assumed that the voltage wasn't getting there at first. Then when I found out it was AC coming out of the Woolwart, I said, okay, the rectifier's got to be in the phone. I was going to take it apart and fix the rectifier. And I said, gee, I better press all the buttons on the front panel first. And it came alive. So, once again, you got to follow my advice, and I don't always follow it. Before you open up the case of anything you're about to do a troubleshooting job on, press every single button on the front panel and back panel and twist any knob, every single knob, and make sure you've tried every combination that can possibly get the thing to operate correctly. Make sure you don't have a pilot error problem. That's suggestion number one. Do everything you can from the outside. Replace the input power cord if it's the kind that can be disconnected. Make sure you're giving it the right DC voltage with the right purity. And try it in all possible modes before you open up the case. But then when you're doing serious troubleshooting on a radio and you do open up the case, don't do anything before you measure all the power supply voltages. Because you guys have heard the story from me, Saddam, many times where Harry Dannels loaned me a radio once, a 2-meter all-mode radio, where the S-meter wasn't working correctly and it was low in gain. It was working, but it was low in gain. And I thought I'd do him a favor and I would fix it for him. And I started troubleshooting. And a week later, when I discovered that every one of the stages in the IF strip was a little bit low in gain, and S-meter, the signal strength meter circuit was a little bit unbalanced, everything was a little bit off. And when I finally got around to it, I found out the 6-volt reference Zener diode was putting out 4.5 volts and was making everything go haywire. And boy, did I waste my time. So, check the power supplies before you proceed. So, you brought us an interesting problem there, Steve. And I guess you got a number of different ways you can go, but at least we know a little bit more now. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KCMM with a comment.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, it is UL approved, and I did take your advice. I took that little piece of foam rubber, and I tried setting it on fire. And basically, it burns, but it goes right out. It smells like an old pair of gym socks when it burns, but at least it goes right out. So I guess that foam rubber is somewhat fire retardant, which is good news. Back to you.
Okay. I heard in the background a slightly noisy signal from Horse Mountain Mobile. Charlie, give us your comments. Anything you do to boost your signal would help, but we heard you pretty well. You got it, Charlie.
Yeah, I'm mobile, so I only got a few minutes. One thing you forgot to comment on, read the manual. Read the manual. And then again, make sure it's plugged in. That's my comment. Let me go back into the woodwork. I'm almost where I'm supposed to be. WA2HM, I'm mobile.
John, good advice, Charlie. Okay, so before you start troubleshooting, Charlie is saying, read the manual. Even if it's written in Japanese English, read it. Read every one of the pages. Then press all the buttons on the front panel and back panel. Twist all the knobs. Pull all the push-pull functions. Do everything you can. A buddy of mine had a very fancy oscilloscope that he bought from me, a Tektronix oscilloscope. And he's a man who shall remain nameless, who lives in Plainview. And he lives on so-and-so drive, Forest Drive. He shall remain nameless. Anyway, he buys this beautiful Tektronix oscilloscope from me. And his complaint was, gee, it's very low in frequency response. It works, but it's very low in frequency response. And he brought it back to me saying, with the implication that, gee, you gave me something that wasn't working so well. And there's a push-pull button on the front panel. And when I pushed the button, it went to full bandwidth. And I said, was that the problem? Well, it was a very hidden function. He wasn't wearing his reading glasses, and you had to look very carefully at the front panel to realize that a particular twistable knob which has an inner knob and an outer knob, a coaxial knob, let's call it, on the front panel of the Sectronics oscilloscope, that when you pulled it out, you got partial bandwidth, and you pushed it in, you got full bandwidth. And so it was a very subtle function. So read the manual, pull the knob, twist all the knobs, pull the button, do all that before you open up the case. Then check all the power supplies. Any further questions or comments, Steve, before we go on to this great big long list of people who signed in tonight, KC2MVP, KQRIW, and the TechNet. I heard an extremely weak RYY, 98% noise, 2% audio. If I wasn't wearing earphones, I would have never recognized that voice. So you have to make some kind of a change there, Joe. But Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Now, Dick, you answered my question in full, 100% as usual, and once again, I thank you, KC2MVP.
Sounds like another satisfied customer, Mel. We're going to send him a bill. We'll be sending it to Baldwin, and he'll be paying us big bucks. Okay. I know that the next person who signed in was Danny, KC2 Lima Yankee Uniform. Danny, you think a lot faster than the rest of us. So you're going to have to talk a little bit slower. And my accent's a little bit different than yours, so talk a little bit slower. I know you've got a second question. KC2, LYU. One of the guys in Brooklyn, KQRIW in the TechNet.
George, it's KC2. Yeah, the other night, I'll be speaking to a few guys on a 10-meter, and it's like 3 dB. After this, it's 7 dB. And another 2 hours, it went up to 20 dB started. And I turn up the automatic tuner. It's tuning up, but don't stop. I don't know. And I have another problem. I turn up the like today. The next day, come back and again the same frequency. And it's, the automatic tuner, you have to tune back and again. Back to you, Skaz. It's over you.
Okay, if I understand you correctly, your automatic antenna tuner sometimes does not come to a solution. And you can be on the exact same frequency on one day, and the next day you come back and it tunes differently. I can think of at least two reasons that can happen, Danny. Number one, there may be a real change in your antenna. You'd be amazed how many times a guy will have a coax cable going to a dipole, where the shield goes to one half of the dipole, the center conductor goes to the other half, and when he first puts it up, everything's hunky-dory, but a couple of years later, the coax cable twists itself, rotates, it's waved in the wind, and the center conductor and the shield occasionally touch each other. Once in a while that happens. So there could be a change in the antenna itself. One possibility. And if you had some kind of a antenna analyzer or standing wave ratio bridge, any kind of instrumentation like that, a Bird wattmeter, where you look at forward power and reverse power on the antenna cable itself after the antenna tuner, that would give you a clue as to whether or not anything is changing in your antenna. That's one possible solution. Second of all, when it comes to an automatic antenna tuner, in some cases, it's a bit rare, but in some cases, there's more than one possible setting of the antenna tuner that will give you a match. Once in a while that happens. In other words, if yours had a tapped coil, for instance, you may tap into the high-frequency coil and set the variable capacitor near maximum, or tap into the next coil lower down and set the variable capacitor near minimum. Occasionally that happens. So these are a couple of guesses on my part. I bet Mel's got a couple of more guesses because he works with HF antennas and antenna tuners quite a bit more than I do. K2KEY, KQRIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, as I explained to Danny this morning on a 10-meter net, the 440 seems to have that kind of chronic problem. To substantiate it, if that it is the rig, which I am almost positive it is, because Howard that was just on here also, and 2GOT had the same radio, had the same problem, and he had to replace the relays. They have a number of relays in there that the points on the relays, I assume, is what goes bad on them, because they don't make good positive contact. And the way to substantiate that, as I said, you put it on a simple dummy load. If the simple dummy load, you load it into that dummy load, and you hear the auto tuner stop hunting, then you know it's your antenna system. If it continues hunting on a dummy load, which you know is a good match, then you will know it's the radio. But I would almost say for sure it's the relays in that circuit, because there was a chronic problem with the 446. Over.
And there's one other thing you can do with your antenna, and that is some antennas with a reasonably high standing wave ratio could fall out of the range of where the antenna tuner is capable of tuning. If you looked at a Smith chart, in theory, if it's a full-size Smith chart, without being expanded, every dot that you could put on that Smith chart at any one particular point represents an exact impedance of, let's say, an antenna, or whatever you're testing. But it's an exact impedance, a certain amount of resistance, a certain amount of reactance. And that reactance can be either an inductive reactance or a capacitor reactance. But every real impedance at a single frequency is one single dot somewhere on that Smith chart. So, in theory, there is no impedance of any antenna you could ever come up with that wouldn't fall somewhere on the Smith chart. So everything is there. Now, if you shade it in the Smith chart for the areas that your particular antenna tuner can cover, it maybe will cover two-thirds of the area of the Smith chart, and it's not a circle in the center. It's lopsided. Your antenna tuner, your automatic antenna tuner, or your manual antenna tuner, will shade in a certain amount of that chart, the Smith chart, where as long as your dot falls into the shaded area, your antenna tuner can handle it. Obviously, there's some dots that you can fall on the Smith chart that are outside of that shaded area, and your antenna tuner can't handle it. But you can force it to handle it by adding another length of cable. No matter where that dot is, you put your circle drawing compass on the Smith chart, you put the sharp point in the center of the Smith chart, you put the pencil on your dot that represents your particular antenna's impedance, and then you swing a full 360 degree circle. As you add more and more extra cable to your feed line, you are walking along that circle. Your new impedance walks along that circle as you add extra feed line, and you walk in the clockwise manner. So with rare exception, you add an extra piece of cable, and that circle you draw is going to now go into the area of the shaded area of your Smith chart where your antenna tuner can handle it. So there's an amazing number of...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's an amazing number of cases where your particular antenna makes your rig unhappy, makes your antenna tuner unhappy. It's not an ideal situation. This can even happen on mobile antennas. Occasionally you'll get a brick amplifier that you put in your automobile to boost the power out of your mobile rig, or the mobile rig itself will occasionally have a magic length of cable with your particular whip antenna on your car, which maybe your whip antenna on the car is a nice impedance at say 144 megs, but on the third harmonic of 144, which is a 432, your particular antenna is a crazy impedance that your final amplifier of your rig doesn't like, and it takes off and oscillates. So there's been a number of cases in the past where a guy will squeeze the mic, talk to somebody, they hear him very nicely, he lets go of the mic, and the final stage of the transmitter, or the final stage of the brick amplifier, keeps right on oscillating. And he can't hear the guy that wants to talk to him. And you add an extra length of cable between your rig in the car and your antenna, and an unstable condition becomes stable. So there's a number of cases where hitting a little more cable does some magic. An antenna tuner is sometimes one of those. It's worth an experiment. I wonder if Mel's ever run into that. Let me ask Mel about that one. K2KUY. K2RIW.
Of course, I think, in fact, we did that Smith chart tutelage, and we showed how you can actually find the different match points and watch to see what happens between the different reactants from plus to minus. So basically, this is not his problem. His problem is that on the rig that he's talking about, Dick, TS-440, Kenwood made that radio with this problem being more or less almost on every one of them. So I can almost assure him that that's what the problem is, the relay. The problem is with Kenwood getting those relays, they are quite expensive. There's the problem. They sit on the printed board, you know, and they charge a ridiculous price for those relays. It's just that's the situation you're stuck with, Dick. Over.
Now, I've had a number of flaky relays and a number of rigs, and if it's a printed circuit board type relay, on occasion, where it's got a clear plastic case, I've managed to open up the case and clean up the contacts. Sometimes I found a piece of hair in there that was making the contacts not work well. The contacts themselves became pitted. The little movable portion wasn't bent right. Is there any possibility on this TS-440, where the Don relay is such a pain to replace and so expensive, could a skillful guy get in there and improve the relay itself, burnish the contacts, bend things, clean things, and whatever? What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2LAW?
The ones I looked at, I understand that they changed the different versions of the relay, but the ones original, these were sealed. The leads come right out of it. It's all molded together. It's, you do not see even where it was joined together, you know, the casing of it. The little brown ones that were very popular, you know, with Japanese equipment. I'm sure you've seen them, Dick. And they are actually non-repairable. I don't know what you could do. Maybe you could, if you want to, maybe grind the top of the case off or something. But, you know, you'd have to really experiment. But I know what you're talking about, the ones with the clear cover that you can pop them open. Or you should pop them open. And I put a razor blade in each side where that little crimp is in the plastic, that where it snaps closed. You put a thin razor blade in it. Each side you can slide the case off, the cover off, but these are not that tight, Dick. Over.
Okay, this particular relay you said from Kenwood is expensive. How expensive? And whenever you order parts from Kenwood, it's a little bit of a pain. You don't just call up like you do with ICOM. ICOM, you call up Belleville, Washington, you tell them what rig you got and what V number or R number the component is, and they mail you one and then bill you. And you're well on your way to getting a repair. With Kenwood, you got to talk to the local dealer, you got to give him money, then he orders it, then it comes back there, then you got to go pick it up. It's a bit of a pain. So how expensive? Do you think anybody makes a substitute relay you might be able to plug in there, Mel? Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know offhand if it's a substitute relay. I think Howard, if he's still on frequency, replaced it in his radio a few years back. And I think he said to me this morning it ran around $20 a relay. I don't know how many years back that is. Let me see if Howard is still on frequency. N2GOT, K2KEY. You still with us, Howie?
Yeah, Mel. N2GOT here. They're about the $20 range. They're made by a company called Omron. Tony, WW2W, helped me put those in. They do have a tendency of going on those older automatic antenna tuners. I do have the Kenwood 440 service manual. I could take a look at it, see which exact relay goes in there. And by the way, comment, one of the ways I was able to test out the tuner exactly is tune it into a proper load, hence a dummy load. Back to your mail, and CGOT.
Okay, very good, Howard. Yeah, I assume that. And that, how many years ago did you replace those relays at $20 a piece, over?
We're looking at probably in the early 90s, probably about 16 years ago or so.
Okay, so Dick, you can adjust the price, $20 maybe in the back in the 90s. You can imagine what they'll charge you today, over.
Yeah, that's a little scary. And for that kind of dollars, I mean, if it was $20 in the 90s, it could easily be $50 today. And, that's a bit pricey, but if you're really in love with the 440, maybe it's the right way to do it. You take, for instance, those Collins rigs that Rich M2EO fixes up. I mean, he likes vintage equipment. He likes them to look like they were brand new right out of Iowa. I can't think of the name of the town now where Collins is located, but if it cost him $40 or $50 to get it back to a brand new condition, he'd go for it. maybe Danny doesn't want to spend that much, and maybe you can find a substitute. So, good luck with that, Danny, and let us know how it turns out. KC2LYU, who's going to talk a little bit slow for us. For me, K2RIW.
Heck, don't worry about the radios. Any radio you want it, I got over here. 7-Eleven is supposed to be fixed. It's still blind of sight. 1000G, it's stored in the closet. It's working. I'm selfish, I get old. I got another radio. Icon 756, Mark 2G, they're working good. I use it on a Friday. 20 dB static. I can't talk into the guy in Long Beach. Back to you, Dick. KSW.
Hey, Mel, that guy Danny's got a little bit of everything. He's got all these rigs. So if you ever need a rare part, we go over there and cannibalize his rigs and get those parts we need. He's got them all. Okay, good luck, Danny. Let us know how that turns out. Now, I think, Joe, if you were able to make some kind of a change, you were very, very noisy when you signed in before. But give it another try. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, I changed it to a different antenna. This is repeater.net/7N6. I was going to ask you a couple of questions, but not really easy to work on the radio this way. Probably noisy. Basically, your internet connection to the repeater is out this way. I can't connect to another repeater.
Okay. When you first signed in before, you were 98% noise and 2% audio. And now you're 5% audio. Very, very noisy, but I think I can hear you. So go ahead with your question, Joe. Go ahead. And I did get you two emails, which I think arrived like a half hour ago, and I haven't had a chance to... Yes, I did. I did go to one of your emails where I tried out open wire line, and I set in numbers for... Let's see now if I can find it. It's not there. It's here. There it is. And I plugged in what they call 25.4/1.02 open wire line. I told them 100 feet at 1.8 megacycles. I told them I had a 50 ohm load, and I asked what was the insertion loss. And the line loss, it gave me, gave it to me two different ways. Not quite sure what's going on here. One line loss was 0.368 dB, and the other one was 6.1 e to the minus 2 dB. 0.06 is what that really means. Exponential mathematics. So I know you have a question about the way this program works. And every one of these programs, you have to get used to the way they use the terms. So the A2RYY, K2RIW.
A6DPZ with a comment.
Go right ahead, DPZ.
Yeah, I just happened to turn on something about wire line going into a 50 ohm load. Isn't that a little bit of a mismatch thing?
It sure is. And sure is. It probably is 450 or 600 ohm line, but still, under that condition, the program predicts for you what is the matched insertion loss. There it is. Now I understand. Now it's clear. Hey, DPZ put this all together for us. So, if it was matched, the line would have 6.1 e to the minus 2. That's a fancy way of saying 0.06 dB of loss is what the line would have. When I put a 50 ohm line on there, and maybe it's a 450 line, that's going to have a 9 to 1 standing wave ratio. Now the insertion loss goes all the way up to 0.37 dB. That makes more sense. So the efficiency comes down to 91% when it was probably 98% when it was matched. So the beauty of this program is it tells you the insertion loss of the cable, matched and unmatched. And your first question, I guess, Joe, is going to be, why in the world should there be a difference? And the answer is, if you don't terminate a transmission line with the exact impedance it was designed for, then there will be some standing wave ratio. It's a fancy way of saying a certain amount of the power you send down the line will not get absorbed by your mismatched load, and a certain amount of it's going to reflect back. And even if you use a broadband tuner, a broad range tuner in the shack, which can match that crazy impedance, and now the power is bouncing back and forth multiple times in the cable, and it finally does get radiated, but because the signal has to traverse the cable multiple times, the insertion loss goes up. In this case, it goes from 0.06 dB to 0.3 dB, simply because of the way I'm using it mismatched and the way I plugged in the numbers. And it's a good thing CPZ told us about that. W-A-2-L-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W.
Well, that's not the question I was going to ask you.
Okay. You have an opportunity to ask another question. Don't forget now, Joe, we're going to be getting some misinterpretation because your signal is very noisy. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, the first thing I was trying to tell you before was you have no internet connection, so I can't talk on this thing full quiet from the internet. So I'm not sure if anybody's aware of that. Your note is offline.
Yes, I do. And too bad you don't have a Yagi on the shack or on the tower that is aimed at this repeater. But go ahead with your question. I'm getting you, I'm going to call it 20% audio and 80% noise. You're pretty easy to see.
Yeah, Dick, W2CEO.
Go ahead with your comment, Andy.
Yeah, just to let you know, the internet connection is down in Glen Oaks. There's a problem with it. But they've been notified. They're going to fix it this week.
Okay, the cavalry's on the way for the repair. So go ahead, Joe, with your real question. K2LIW listening.
All right. The line I put in there was 450, I think it said AWRL, 450. Typical or something like that, 450 ladder line. If you go back to your chart and choose that choice, you'll see the answer gives you. I was looking for 3.5 meg and a length of 100 feet. If you try that, you'll get a particular answer, which is what I got. It's like 5.16 space minus 2 TV.
By the way, Joe, did you use the program that's called on the website you gave me? Did you use RF transmission line loss calculator / enhanced or RF transmission line loss calculator period? Which one of those did you use, Joe? Go ahead.
I used the one called enhanced.
Okay, I'm on the one enhanced, and I'm now selecting a transmission line. And when it comes to the open wire lines, there it is, open wire line. There's four of them. Which one of the four did you choose?
I may have picked the wrong one. I picked one that said AWRL typical 450. That's what they meant ladder wise with that particular choice. That's what I was going by.
Okay. I've now plugged in ARL general 450 ladder line, length 100 feet. What frequency would you like me to plug in?
3.5 meg.
Okay. I just plugged in. What load? Okay, I'm hearing it. I'm hearing you on the input. Oh, what load again? Okay, match. Let's see if I can find that. Okay, it's a 450 ohm line, so I plugged in match 450, and I'm waiting for the answer, and there's the answer I got. Line loss 5.1 e to the minus 2. And I got that both for line loss match and unmatched. So 5.1 e to the minus 2. That's a fancy way of saying 0.05 dB total line loss for 100 feet of 450 ohm line. Wonder if that makes sense, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, you just told me the answer I'm looking for to my question. Yeah, I've never seen stuff come out that way as far as the answer. 0.05. Okay, so that's a lot less than RG 13. There's another piece of line that you had there with the system. I just come back to the question I was asking about when I was transmitting on an 80-meter dipole. I think I'm on a frequency or something like that. Extremely basic thing you may ask, but it had to do with the line loss. You talked about the signal going up and down the cable like many, many times. Of course, the lateral line had a lot less work than the RF cable. RG13 is better. Now you're just trying to understand the difference in decibels and line loss. Because it's only RG13 is the same configuration, 100 feet, 3.5 meg.
not familiar with the so-called exponential mathematics display. See, if your insertion loss of a particular piece of cable was 14.1 dB, it would write down that number. If it was 1.4 dB, it would write down that number. If it